trying to protect you. So in our story tonight, God wants to bless the Israelites with a good life, and thus is moving them to the promised land.
Let me see if this works.
Where he wants to live in close relationship with them. All right, so here we go. As we see, the continuing picture of salvation, part one is delivering them from something. Okay, so it's one thing to be delivered from, but then what are you being delivered to? So part two is entering into relationship with God and being delivered into something good. So previously, last week, we talked about the Exodus as this picture of what salvation is all about. And so tonight we want to talk about what is this that they're being delivered to. So we read where in Exodus chapter 19. In fact, let's go to, we'll pick a couple chapters tonight to stop at for a moment. So go to Exodus 19. Let's take a look at this pivotal chapter here. And we see that in Exodus 19, God brings the Israelites to Mount Sinai. And this is the location where God spoke to Moses from the burning bush. So in Exodus 3, God spoke to one man from a burning bush. In Exodus 19, God is going to speak to all the Israelites from what's essentially a burning mountain. And so both of these encounters stress the holiness and power of God. So in chapter 19, it says, on the third new moon after the people of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that day they came to the wilderness of Sinai. Skip down to verse 3. While Moses went up to God, the Lord called to him on the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and to all the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you are to speak to the people of Israel. Take just a moment. Chat with your neighbor for 60 seconds. Because, you know, if we have our Bible knowledge, we're going, wait, Levites. The Levites are the ones who are going to be the priests, right? So here is, I think I have it as a question. Yeah, if it's going to only be Levites who are priests, then how are the Israelites as a whole a kingdom of priests? So take 60 seconds and talk about that. All right. So, some good discussion. Sounds like some good discussion was going on. Do we have any answers that want to be shared? Cricket, cricket, cricket. I'll wait. 5, 4, 3, 2. Okay, so what Jesse shared tonight, and for our listeners at home, he's saying, you know, we all have a story to tell. And God is using the Israelites to tell a story. I mean, as we see this grand plan of redemption. And so that they're to be a holy people, and God is going to use them to tell his story, tell this story he wants to tell. Yeah, so I think what we see here is this, you know, if you think about a priest goes on behalf of the people to God, right, like the priests that were serving in the temple, we see that the Israelites as a whole, they're going to be a model for others, right? That their monotheism, they're following after God, these commandments that they're about to get, and they're going to live differently, that they are pointing the world towards God. And so in that way, it's like they're this kingdom of priests. All right, so go back to chapter 19, and we see the encounter on Mount Sinai. And in verse 9, and the Lord said to Moses, behold, I am coming to you in a thick cloud,
that the people may hear when I speak with you and may also believe in you forever. So the people have to consecrate themselves and go down to verse 16. On the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast that all the people in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire. And the smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And we're going to see that Moses receives the Ten Commandments. Now, something that's interesting that was pointed out at some point, we're about to talk about the Ten Commandments, but just to look at chapter 20, verse 18, they get the commandments, then 18, now when all the people saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled, and they stood afar off and said to Moses, "You speak to us, and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us, lest we die." So you see that kind of awe and that fear of what this must have been like at Mount Sinai. And isn't it interesting that you see, well, Moses considered a great prophet, and we're going to see prophets follow. That the people are like, hey, you talk to God, and then you tell us, and we'll listen. And we see prophets, God is going to use prophets all throughout the Old Testament. So God chose Moses for this special task in chapter 3, and now in chapter 19, he chooses the entire nation to be this kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So this brings us to the Ten Commandments. In Exodus 20, God presents the Israelites with these foundational terms for this new relationship. And so the commandments define the terms by which the nation of Israel can have a wonderful life in the Promised Land with God living right there among them. And the Ten Commandments provide the most basic foundational terms for how Israel should live as a people of God. And if you don't remember each of the ten, one way to think about it is the first four about our relationship with God, and then the others with our relationship with one another. So we see the Lord alone must be worshipped, don't have any other gods, don't make or worship idols, don't misuse the name of the Lord, keep the Sabbath day holy. And then honor your parents, don't commit murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't give false testimony, don't covet other people's stuff. And so the next several chapters in Exodus contain expansions and explanations and applications of the Ten Commandments. And so if the Israelites keep the rules, God will live with them in the Promised Land and bless them. And so what happens in chapter 24 is you see that this covenant is confirmed. Just as we talked about the covenant made with Abraham, now we have the Mosaic covenant, which goes along with, but is different and distinct from, the covenant of Abraham. And so in chapter 24, verse 3, Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules, and all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words that the Lord has spoken, we will do." So this covenant is made. It's not identical to, but complements the covenant with Abraham. So what we see now is that this promise and the implication of God's presence. And this kind of covenant formula, we saw this already. I will be your God, you will be my people, I will dwell in your midst. And so it's kind of like this formula-like statement that God uses to describe the covenant relationship between him and his people. And God's promise of giving his presence to Israel is one of the most significant promises in Scripture, and it's going to echo throughout the rest of the story. But there's implications for this, right? God's presence brings power and demands holiness. God is a holy God, and his presence demands that holiness for everything and everyone in the vicinity. And so, first, God will need an appropriate place. And that's where we get the second half of Exodus. It's very much about the building of the tabernacle. So from 25 to 40 is largely filled with God's instructions regarding how to construct the tabernacle. And the tabernacle is going to be this movable, mobile, tent-like temple where God's presence will dwell. And eventually Solomon will build the temple. Now, we have an interruption to the story of the golden calf. All right, and so while God is giving Moses the Ten Commandments on the mountain, the Israelites down below have already abandoned him and started to worship a golden calf. But after this interruption, the Israelites do build the tabernacle. And in Exodus, the glory of the Lord actually comes and fills the tabernacle. So here's kind of a replica of maybe something of what it would have looked like with the tabernacle. And then inside, all the instructions of where it would be. And so we see instructions given for the sanctuary in chapter 25, and also the Ark of the Covenant. And so what happens here at the end of Exodus, then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. In all the travels of the Israelites, whenever the cloud lifted from above the tabernacle, they would set out. But if the cloud did not lift, they did not set out until the day it lifted. So the cloud of the Lord was over the tabernacle by day, and fire was in the cloud by night, in the sight of all the Israelites during all their travels. Could you imagine what that would be like? And we talked about, we're going to see the Israelites up and down, back and forth. But they have this visible manifestation of God. And yet we still, that's why when somebody says, well, if God would do this for me, well, there's no guarantee, right? Because it's a matter of the heart, not always a matter of evidence. I mean, the Israelites had God's presence in front of them, and yet we see the challenges that they face as a people. All right, so that goes to the end of Exodus, and then the central theme of Leviticus is this idea of be holy because I am holy. Israel will need to know how to deal with this new reality of God's presence in their midst. How are they going to relate to him, and how can they even approach him? And so the book of Leviticus answers these questions. And so that flow from Exodus to Leviticus is logical and smooth. Now, when we do our yearly Bible reading, right, we're always excited when we make it through Leviticus and Numbers, but we see that it serves a very, very important person, a very important purpose. Because Leviticus, it instructs the Israelites on how to live with the holy, awesome God in their midst. And so that theme, be holy because I am holy, is repeated. And you know, without a explanation of the sacrificial system in Leviticus, then our understanding of the great sacrifice of Jesus in the New Testament would be seriously limited. So things are structured in Leviticus around clean and unclean things, holy and profane. And I really debated what kind of video to show tonight. I'm going to show a different one that is going to explore the holiness of God. So you'll see these things revisited here in just a minute when we get to the end to recap. Because God is holy and man is sinful, Leviticus is providing those details regarding sacrifices which are important in dealing with sin and reestablishing relationship with God. I told you we'd move fast. Leviticus, done and slide. Now, Numbers. The book of Numbers details how Israel refused to enter the promised land and as a result wandered in the wilderness. So it picks up the story, right, at Mount Sinai. They're camped out there for like a year. And so God leads Israel to the promised land. And this unbelievable thing happens. Again, let's think about all that has happened. That we talked about the Exodus and the signs and the plagues and the crossing of the Red Sea. And God brings them to the promised land, and they don't enter. Let's take a look at Numbers. We're going to be in Numbers chapter 13 and 14. When they see that it will require faith and hard work to conquer the promised land, they rebel against God, and they refuse to follow him into the land. So as you know, the spies, in chapter 13, the spies are sent to Canaan. And at the end of 40 days, they come back. And Joshua and Caleb are going to be the only ones that they all give a good report about the land. But only Joshua and Caleb are going to say, no, we should take the land. The other 10 incite fear in the people. Right? They say, it's great, it's everything God said, but verse 28, verse 13, however, the people who dwell in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And so Caleb, in verse 30, though, he tries to quiet the people. He said, let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it. Then the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we are. So they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land that they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone to spy out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people that we saw in it are of great height. So notice in chapter 14, then all the congregation raised a loud cry, and the people wept that night.
And all the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become a prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt?" And they said to one another, "Let us choose a leader and go back to Egypt." It's easy for us to judge, right? Because hindsight's 20/20, we hold a whole narrative and say, how could they do this? But think about how fickle we as humans can be. Kind of like this morning when we were talking about generosity. We know we should be generous, but we get fearful and we can't trust that God can provide. And so these folks have experienced all these things. They're saying, well, we should go back to Egypt. Notice in verse 20 that those people are going to get exactly what they asked for. Then the Lord said, "I have pardoned according to your word, but truly as I live and as all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, none of the men who have seen my glory and my signs that I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not obeyed my voice, shall see the land that I swore to give to their fathers. And none of those who despised me shall see it." Only Caleb and Joshua, the spies, are going to go in. But there's going to be a whole generation that's going to have to die off. Verse 26, "And the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, How long shall this wicked congregation grumble against me? I have heard the grumblings of the people of Israel, which they grumble against me. Say to them, As I live, declares the Lord, what you have said in my hearing, I will do to you. Your dead bodies shall fall in this wilderness, and all of your number, listed in the census from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me, not one shall come into the land where I swore that I would make you dwell, except Caleb and Joshua. But your little ones," you know those ones that you said that would be prey? "Your little ones, one who said you would become prey, I will bring in, and they shall know the land that you have rejected. But as for you, your dead bodies shall fall in the wilderness, and your children shall be shepherds in the wilderness 40 years and shall suffer for your faithlessness until the last of your dead bodies lies in the wilderness. According to the number of days in which you spied out the land, 40 days, a year for each day you shall bear in your iniquity, 40 years, and shall know my displeasure." And then the guys that gave the bad report, they're going to die of a plague right away as well. Could you imagine, right, think about a time that you've been reprimanded or corrected. It never feels good, right? Could you imagine, right, that feeling? These people that have grumbled, and then God says, okay, you're going to get exactly what you asked for. And so notice what the people do in verse 39. "When Moses told these words to all the people of Israel, the people mourned greatly." No surprise there, right? They're basically being called out on all of this. "And they rose early in the morning and went up to the heights of the hill country, saying, Here we are, we will go up to the place that the Lord has promised, for we have sinned. But Moses said, Why now are you transgressing the command of the Lord, when that will not succeed? Do not go up, for the Lord is not among you, lest you be struck down by your enemies. For there the Amalekites and the Canaanites are facing you, and you shall fall by the sword. Because you have turned back from following the Lord will not be with you. But they presume to go up to the heights of the hill country, although neither the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord nor Moses departed out of the camp. Then the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in that hill country came down and defeated them and pursued them." So the whole point of the Exodus event was to deliver Israel from Egypt and deliver them to the Promised Land. And so we see, as judgment, God sends them back into the wilderness, where they're going to wander for 40 years until that entire generation dies off, just as they requested. And a new generation will arise that's ready to enter the Promised Land. But God wants his people to understand clearly how they must live in relationship with him. So right before they go into the land, we are presented with Deuteronomy. This is the terms for a blessed life in the Promised Land with God in their midst. So the Israelites now, they are at the Jordan River, and the Promised Land is lying just across the river. And Deuteronomy means second law. So this is basically a second presentation to Israel. And think about it. A generation has passed by. This seems appropriate. A generation has passed by, and they're about to enter the Promised Land. You see, it'd be a good reminder, a good rallying cry, like these things that we know. Let's remember them. And so what we see is Deuteronomy expands, explains, and clarifies some of the earlier laws, as well as adding some new material. So there's a lot there, but we could, again, in our one class where we're covering all of this, we could summarize some of the challenges of Deuteronomy in this way: remaining faithful to God, avoiding idolatry, and to practice justice. So we see here that they are exhorted to remain faithful to God and worship Him alone. Deuteronomy 6, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Avoiding idolatry, the caution about allowing pagan inhabitants to corrupt them with idolatry and immoral practices. So in Deuteronomy 6, do not follow other gods, the gods of the peoples around you. For the Lord your God who is among you is a jealous God, and his anger will burn against you, and he will destroy you from the face of the land. That's a fair warning, right? Don't do this. And again, to practice justice. It's their challenge to be concerned with justice and compassion on those who are weak and vulnerable, the orphans, the widows, the foreigners, the poor. So Deuteronomy 10, for the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and accepts no bribes. He defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow, and loves the foreigner residing among you, giving them food and clothing. And you are to love those who are foreigners, for you yourselves were foreigners in Egypt. They knew what it was like to be in that situation. So Deuteronomy is presented to the Israelites as a series of speeches that Moses delivers to them just prior to entering the Promised Land. And if Israel obeys, there are going to be blessings. And if they disobey, well, there are going to be consequences and curses. And God warns them that they will lose his presence and the right to live in the Promised Land. So if you go to the end of, let's go to the very end of Deuteronomy. It's kind of a transitional moment in the story. Let's just read chapter 34. Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the top of Pisgah, which is opposite Jericho, and the Lord showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan, all Naphtali, the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah, as far as the western sea, the Negev and the plain, that is the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees, as far as Zoar. And the Lord said to him, this is the land of which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Again, going all the way back to covenant, I'm the father, I'm the God of your fathers. I will give it to your offspring. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go over there. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord, and he buried him in the valley in the land of Moab opposite Beth Peor. But no one knows the place of his burial to this day. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eye was undimmed and his vigor unabated. Basically saying he was still in great shape, right? I mean, he was could have still kept going. And the people of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days, then the days of weeping and mourning for Moses were ended. And Joshua the son of Nun was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. So the people of Israel obeyed him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. And there has not arisen a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. None like him for all the signs and the wonders that the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land, and for all the mighty power and all the great deeds of terror that Moses did in the sight of all of Israel. So we're going to see this handoff to Joshua. And that's going to be the next chapter in our story, where it's going to be the conquest. I think, let's see, yeah. Let's have a video where we're going to watch about the holiness of God. So instead of kind of recapping, because we covered so much, but I think this does a good job of kind of taking the holiness of God that we're introduced to here, and it's going to play out some implications all the way to the end. So we'll watch this.
You've probably heard the word holy before, or at least sang it in a church song once or twice. And for most people, this idea is really just connected to being a morally good person. So God is holy because he's morally perfect.
Yeah, that is part of it. But in the Bible, the idea of holiness is even bigger and more rich. What it's really describing is how God is the creative force behind the whole universe. He's the one and only being with the power to make a world full of such beauty and life. And so all these abilities, they make God utterly unique, which is the meaning of the word holy. So a helpful way to think about God's holiness is by using the sun as a metaphor. The sun is unique, at least within our solar system, and it's really powerful. It's the source of all this beautiful life on our planet, and so you could say that the sun is holy. And you can actually take this metaphor even further, in that the whole area around the sun is also holy.
Yeah, because the closer you get to the sun, the more intense it gets.
Yeah, exactly. So that very power and goodness that generates all this life is also dangerous. I mean, the sun, if you get too close, will annihilate you. And in the same way, there's this paradox at the heart of God's own holiness. Because if you're impure, his presence is dangerous to you. And not because it's bad, but because it's so good. And so the first time we see this paradox of God's holiness, it's in the story of Moses and the burning bush.
So God tells Moses to take off his sandals because he's standing on holy ground. And Moses covers his face in fear, and God says, hey, don't come any closer. It's intense.
It's actually that intensity of God's holiness that's explored even more in the stories about Israel's temple, which was the main place where God's holy presence was located. And at the center of the temple was this room called the Most Holy Place, the hot spot of God's presence. And whether you're an Israelite living in the land around the temple or a priest working right in the temple, you're in proximity to God's holy presence, which is dangerous.
Yeah, this is a problem. So how's it supposed to work?
Well, in the Bible, the solution is that you need to become pure.
So like being morally pure.
Yeah, and that's easy enough to understand. But the Bible spends a lot of time talking about another kind of purity, being ritually pure, which is a state where you separate yourself from anything related to death, like touching things like diseased skin or dead bodies or even certain bodily fluids. All these make you impure. And becoming ritually impure isn't necessarily sinful. What's wrong is waltzing into God's presence when you're in an impure state. And so that's why God gave the Israelites very clear instructions for knowing when they were impure, steps to become pure, so they could go into the temple again.
So that's what the book of Leviticus is about.
Right. But it doesn't stop there. This idea keeps developing. So later in the scriptures, we find this really interesting story by a prophet named Isaiah. And he has this crazy vision where he's in the temple and he's right in God's presence. He's totally terrified.
Yeah, he knows the rules. He shouldn't even be in there. And he's worried about being destroyed.
And then this crazy creature called a seraphim.
Yeah, that is a crazy creature.
Totally. So it flies over with a hot coal, and then it sears Isaiah's lips with the coal and says something really weird. Your guilt is taken away, and your sin is atoned for.
So this burning coal somehow makes Isaiah pure.
Yeah, it's remarkable, because normally, if you touch something impure, it transfers its impurity to you. But now here's this new idea, where you have this coal, this very holy and pure object, and it touches Isaiah, and it transfers its purity to him. Isaiah is not destroyed by God's holiness, he's transformed by it. I mean, the implications of this are just huge. But there's one more development, this time from another prophet, Ezekiel. And he has this vision where he's standing at the temple, and he sees water trickling out from it. And then that water turns into a stream, and then it grows into a deep river that starts flowing through the desert, leaving this trail of green trees behind it. And then it flows into the Dead Sea, making everything fresh and alive.
So instead of becoming pure first and then going into the temple, here God's holiness comes out from the temple, making things pure and bringing them to life. What does it all mean?
So we don't know. Until we meet this man, Jesus. And he claims that he's fulfilling all of these ancient visions, but in surprising new ways. So Jesus, he went around touching people who are impure, people with skin diseases, a woman with chronic bleeding, or dead people. And when he touches them, their impurity should transfer over to Jesus, but instead, Jesus's purity transfers to them and actually heals their bodies.
Jesus is like that holy coal in Isaiah's vision.
Right. And Jesus claimed that he was the human embodiment of God's own holiness, and that he and his followers were now God's temple, so that through them, God's holy presence would go out into the world and bring life and healing and hope. And so this is why Jesus described his followers as having streams of living water flowing out of them.
So this is our part of the story where we find ourselves now, but Where's this all heading?
So the last pages of the Bible end with a final vision about God's holiness. And this time it's by a guy named John. And in his vision, we see the whole world made completely new. The entire earth has become God's temple. And Ezekiel's river is there, flowing out of God's presence, immersing all creation, removing all impurity, and bringing everything back to life.
All right, so what we've seen tonight is that these things that we're introducing in these Old Testament books that sometimes seem like they're just full of a bunch of rules that don't apply to us anymore, well, it's full of concepts and themes that are going to be revisited over and over and expanded upon, and we see so much fulfillment of Jesus. So while the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant still is in the background, it's Deuteronomy that takes center stage. And the question is, will Israel obey and be blessed? Or will they disobey and be judged? Two weeks from tonight, we will take a look at the conquest for the land. But I hope that tonight, one thing that maybe is helpful is to see just what God's holiness, the consequences of that, and what it implies. So we're going to close out in prayer, and if you need to take the Lord's Supper, Dame is going to meet you in that back room right there, and we will sing. I thought it would be appropriate to sing Holy, 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 so we'll sing that after we pray, so you can go out, and then we'll dismiss in groups. Let's bow together. Dear Lord, you are an awesome, holy God. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here tonight, to study your word, and to see the grand story and the narrative and the work, the redemptive work that you've been planning all along for us. We thank you so much how it culminated in the coming of your Son, for his life, for his sacrifice, his death, and his resurrection, and what that means for us. We thank you for your mercy, your grace, your compassion, your forgiveness. And Lord, may we grow closer to you and grow in our knowledge of the word and be a light to the world around us. Thank you so much for all you do for us every day. It's your Son's name we pray.